The name of this show?
Linoleum Knife.
I offered for you to nap, and you no, said I did you
nap.
Were awake.
No, I'm awake. Okay. I napped.
Right.
I had a little 15-minute little unconsciousness.
Okay.
Everything's all right.
All right.
I'm ready.
Okay.
I'm always ready for extreme podcasting. Today will be a little light podcasting, I think. I'm feeling, I'm not tired, I'm not sleepy, I'm alert from my miniature nap.
Okay.
I'm feeling kind of it's like a mellow Sunday afternoon sort of thing.
Okay.
Today's light podcast.
You're easy like Sunday morning.
Like Sunday at 3 p.m. That's really easy. So the name of the show, I said it twice because it's so nice. We're Linoleum Knife. It's a podcast about movies. We are film critics. Also, we're married.
That's it in a nutshell.
I'm thinking about the person who's listening for the very first time. That's my new thing.
Welcome.
My new thing is, because I was listening to other podcasts that I think are terrible and boring.
That we will not name.
And how efficient they are each time. Like, I'll listen to like a couple, two or three episodes for at least a little bit until I get fed up. But everybody in these other podcasts, they are really about building the brand right from the get-go. Like, and so if you're
Here's the thing, and this is what the thing is.
If you're a new listener, they don't want to lose you in the first 3 minutes, like I think sometimes you and I have done. And they always say, this is a podcast about a thing, and then we are the people who do the podcast. And they're very, very professional with introducing themselves.
Yes.
And so we're
good podcasts do that too.
That's actually our new thing.
Not just the crappy ones.
Our new thing is, I've decided, is we're going to get real professional.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
I look forward to that.
Yeah.
Why don't you introduce us then?
You are Alonzo Duralde, a film critic, and you write for therap.com, and also you're on What the Flick, which is not .com.
No.
But it's on the internet.
Yes.
So it's close enough.
On YouTube.
It's on the YouTube.com.
Correct.
And then
You are Dave White.
And you're fixing to be, tomorrow, you're going to be on The Point.
Yeah, I thought that was going to be up by now. But at some point.
Well, you don't control them.
I do not.
You don't boss them around.
No, but I'm saying they told us.
You're not the one that tells them what to do.
I'm not telling anybody what to do. But we taped it on Wednesday, and they said, well, it should go up, if not Friday, then for sure Saturday.
I see.
And it's Sunday.
Okay, well.
And I don't think it's gone up yet, or if it has, they haven't told us.
It'll be Monday. You haven't looked for it, though, have you?
Not
actually. Lazy.
Well, I thought they would tell us. Anyway, I will post a link to it on the Linoleum Knife page on Facebook when it goes up.
Yeah.
And if you aren't already following the Linoleum Knife page, please go and follow it right now.
Sure.
Press like.
Yes.
Anyway, and you are Dave White, and you are the film critic for movies.com.
Yes, I am. And then the thing the thing that makes us not just two guys who are talking about movies is that we're in our own home right now.
Right.
And we're a couple.
Yes.
That's gays.
Legally wed in California.
Gay, yeah,
in during California, the window yeah. during which and we like could get legally
wed. Half a dozen other states.
Yes, I guess, recognized elsewhere.
Like if we went to Washington right now.
Right.
We'd still be married.
Correct.
State if we went or to Oklahoma DC, right
not
now,
so much.
We would be jailed.
But Iowa, however, totally down.
Imprisoned in Oklahoma.
Yes. Well, no. Just we would be treated rudely by waitresses. Although I'm sure there are lovely people I would in like Oklahoma, any, too.
If anyone is listening in Oklahoma and can dispute that we would be imprisoned.
I think we would meet a mix of people like anywhere else. Nice folks, not so good folks. Oklahoma does have, we learned this week, one of the nation's leading pre-K public educational programs.
Except for gay kids.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Gay kids are in prison.
They are put in a bag and thrown in the river. Except, luckily, there are no rivers in Oklahoma, so they're okay.
I don't know that we've ever talked about the fact, like at the very beginning of the show, I don't know that we've ever talked about the fact that we are a couple. This may be the very first time we've ever done that.
It might be.
I think we just assumed that people... No?
No, I think we've mentioned it in like the
show notes. I guess we mentioned it in passing.
Or something. I don't know.
I don't know.
People who leave us nice reviews on iTunes, a lot of them mention it.
They mention it?
Yes.
That we're the gays together.
Our Bickerson's quality.
That we're gay together.
Mm-hmm. That we gay out.
And are gay for each other.
Yes. And not gay for pay.
And I'm...
Because this podcast is free.
You are... also gay for Real Genius.
And you were gay for Bailatar.
And 16 Candles. I'm gay for Bailatar.
Yes.
And Bresson.
And Kylie Minogue.
And Kylie, well, yeah. So we're going to, let's discuss some films from the current cinema.
Why don't we? That's a snappy idea.
I would like to begin with Escape from Planet Earth, so that we can escape it forever.
Okay, fine.
After we're done talking about it for the next 5 minutes.
God. It's an animated adventure.
Talk about it. Oh, Describe the plot. I forgot things already.
Okay, so there's a planet called Bob, B-A-A-B, populated with blue aliens that explore the universe. And
they reminded me of the creatures in Delgo.
Which I didn't see.
That's an animated film no that one almost saw. Nobody saw, yeah.
I think that was like, until the Oogie Loves came along, that was the record holder for like biggest flop wide release movie or something, right?
Maybe.
Something like that.
That might be true.
Anyway, okay, so these aliens who may or may not look like the cast of Delgo.
The Delgo creatures are a little bumpy-headeder.
Oh, okay.
Bumpier in the head.
Mm-hmm.
They're bumpier in the head.
Okay.
Not bumpy-headeder.
They're more like a Ray Kawakubo.
Bumpy Hediter is the name of a person in Beautiful Creatures, though.
We get to that. Anyway, so the hero of this planet is this this brash astronaut named Scorch Supernova. And it turns out that, you know, while he is indeed brave and foolhardy, the real brains of the operation, the guy who kind of gets him out of all of his scrapes and makes sure that he comes home safely, is his underappreciated brother, Gary Supernova, who runs Mission Control. And so Scorch gets sent off on a mission to the Dark Planet, a.k.a. Earth, and Gary thinks it's a bad idea because aliens go to that planet and never, ever return. And... Scorch decides he's going to go anyway, and he fires Gary, and they stop talking. And then, of course, Gary goes and gets captured by this evil general voiced by William Shatner.
Right.
And so Gary has to go to the rescue, and blah, blah, blah. They learn to love each other, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
This is... The thing is...
It sucks.
I can't even hate this movie, because it doesn't have... It would have to be more interesting to be hateable.
Right.
It's just there.
You have to kind of earn... If I despise you, you've angered me.
Yeah, you've done something.
You've done something to get me angry.
This is like unflavored gelatin.
Yeah, there's just nothing. There's nothing. This is nothing. And as we were talking on our way out of the movie, I feel bad when a movie is nothing.
Yeah.
Because so many people, so many friends of ours who live here in Los Angeles who work on films.
Yeah.
Who are all behind, you know, the scenes kind of people who do special effects and who do animation and who you know, are second ADs and, you know, things of that
this
nature.
This isn't like some indie with three people and a red camera. This is like, you know, animation.
It takes a lot of, it takes many villages.
Yeah.
Many post-production villages to raise a terrible, mediocre animated film, and it looks good.
Yeah, yeah.
There are sequences in this movie that look really cool because
it is competent.
It is almost realistic. The animation at some in some moments feels like you're looking at a real three-dimensional object.
The 7-Eleven is eerily photorealistic.
And so I hate it.
Boy, do they get the mileage out of that 7-Eleven.
We'll get to that. I hate it when there's nothing going on in a film because I think that's
a wasted opportunity.
Wasted time. All those people, you know, they all got paid, so that's fine. That's good for them. But, you know, at the end of the project, they can't look at it and say, yes, I'm proud of this thing that happened. You know, they might be proud of their individual technical prowess or whatever they've done to produce it. No, it's a deflating sort of experience to watch a movie like this.
It's like when you're a kid and you accidentally swallow a penny and eventually you poop it out and it's still a penny. And it has not been... It has left no impact on you whatsoever. It just went right through. That's the movie. It goes into your eyes.
Did you ever swallow a penny as a child?
I did. There's an x-ray somewhere. Yeah, I did.
How do you do that? What were the circumstances in which you swallowed a penny?
I was like 3 years old.
Oh, so you were dumb and just putting all the things in objects in your mouth.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever did that.
No.
I was a cautious three-year-old.
I'm sure. You were already afraid of the world.
Yeah. I looked both ways, even at three.
See, I'm Scorch, and you're Gary.
Yeah, Gary saves the world at the end, by the way.
But the two of them learn to work together and play to each other's strengths.
Sure. I could...
Anyway, yeah, this movie...
Give that a thought or two, maybe.
This movie slides through your brain and out the other end. And
like a penny in poop.
Like a penny in poop. It's
The product placement is annoying. Slurpees figure prominently in many scenes.
It's not even delicately, you know,
no, it's like, Slurpees are great. Here's a Slurpee. You know, it's like that.
It's the kind of thing that, like, 30 Rock would have done but made fun of at the same time.
Yeah.
These guys just do it.
Right. They're...
you know, good voice people, it's, you know...
Are not...
Given anything fun to do. You know, Rob Corddry and Sarah Jessica Parker and Jane Lynch and Craig Robinson. And
there are silly jokes about James Cameron.
And Pixar.
There's factual problems when they bring up Roswell. Where I grew up.
Yes.
Part of my childhood I spent in Roswell, New Mexico. And... like they show there that there are mountains in the back. Now there were mountains in the back
in the
of
TV show.
The TV show Roswell.
Maybe that's how they did.
They shot it in Burbank, where there are, you know, hills and whatnot.
Yes.
No hill. No mountains. No, none. You have to drive quite a way to get to some mountains.
Because New Mexico has mountainous places.
Yeah, in the middle, like right down the middle.
Like Santa Fe and Taos.
And Ruidoso, which is like a little ways west of Roswell, where folks go skiing.
You know what Ruidoso means in Spanish, right?
I should, probably.
Noisy.
It is the opposite of noisy.
Noisy New Mexico.
Yeah, it's the opposite of noisy. What else was it? Oh, and the William Shatner character is supposed to have been a child. In 1947.
Right, yeah.
Which would make him
70-something.
In his mid-70s, which he's clearly not.
The character, yeah.
It was like, oh, so you're actually older than my late mother. You know, that's not a thing. There was some talking mashed potatoes that I appreciated. I like it when mashed potatoes are animated and speak.
I almost laughed when Gary, upon landing on Earth, crashes through Area 48, 49, 50, well, before getting to Area 51.
That was all right.
But yeah, there's nothing. You can't, like I said, I can't even hate this movie. It's not interesting enough to hate.
And the big clue to how ineffective it is the children that were in the screening with us.
Yeah, they did not screen this for the press, mind you.
They didn't screen it for the press. We went Friday morning, and there were. I'd say a good 20 children and their adults.
Keepers, yeah.
The kids were going, man, 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 man. Like through the whole thing. Toddlers to age
eight or nine.
And they ran up and down the aisles. A couple of them ran right down front in front of the screen and just sort of like ran around and played tag. Like, movie's still going. They don't care. They're just like, we want to go play down front.
It's like how the drive-in theaters just a backdrop would have to the playground front. Before the screen.
Or the Monkey Village,
yes.
You know, at the drive-in. Don't take your child to see this. There's no other reason you would go unless you're an animation nerd and you have to see all the animated features.
I mean, the thing is, I guess, what else is out there right now for the littlest? Is there anything?
Die Hard.
Rent The Secret World of Arrietty. Do your kids a favor.
Yeah. Panda Go Panda.
Yeah.
That's...
We'll be talking about
how little are they? Panda Go Panda. That's, if they're real little, Panda Go Panda. We're done talking about that.
Yes, absolutely.
Film, there's nothing left.
Bleh. Let's talk about Die Hard. Won the weekend.
What did it win?
It was the highest grossing film of the weekend. Although
that winning.
Yeah, but it did disappointing numbers. They were expecting it to do better, and it got a decent cinema score. Which surprised care? Me.
I mean, is that a thing that our listeners? You can respond to this question I have for you. Do you give an F about how much money these movies are making? Is box office a thing?
I'm not consumed by it, but I think it's interesting to see what people go to and, you know, what movies do well despite getting terrible reviews, like Die Hard.
Or Identity Thief,
for that matter, which had much less of a second weekend drop than it should have for being stinky.
Yep.
But anyway, yeah, look for your Die Hard. Based, you know, it's the fifth entry in a franchise that began with one of the great action movies of all time. 1988 Die Hard, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year.
I need you to pause the recording for a bit because...
Okay.
Yeah.
And we have returned through a mystery of time and space.
I'm in a situation with my...
head.
With my all the boogers that I have inside of me.
I didn't think we were going to go there. Okay.
I had on Wednesday... I had oral surgery, and it was not great. I mean,
as opposed to all the time,
it was not nearly as pleasurable as I was anticipating. And so
I was misled as to how fun this was going to be.
Yeah. Here are the rules that they gave me for post-oral surgery care. No brushing your teeth for like 48 hours. That's gross. Mm. No mouthwash for an indefinite amount of time, no rinsing, no spitting, no... So your mouth just has this grossness going on in it all the time.
Well, you get to brush now. You just can't...
I've returned to brushing. So happy to return to brushing. But I also can't blow my nose for like a month. Ugh. And I'm an allergic person to the air. Mm. So that's just been torment for the past 4 days. If you're a first-time listener and you think that I sound this way because I'm congested, no, I always sound this way. But today I'm also congested and I'm sniffling and trying to figure out what to do with all of these boogers that I have. I can't blow them.
I think blowing your nose is one of those things that you take for granted until you can't do it.
Until the doctor says no, you can't.
And then suddenly it's the greatest thing ever.
It'll disrupt the healing blood clot that must form in your mouth.
Mm.
Yeah. Now you know all the things.
I'm sure everyone's so glad we shared all
this
that.
This report about boogers has been brought to you by Linoleum Knife, a podcast about film. Yes.
If any mucus thinners would like to sponsor this program, yes, do let us know.
Die Hard.
So, yeah, okay. So this is a franchise that's had its ups and downs over the years. I like Die Hard 2.
I like them all.
I was surprised to find out
all that, of them, that William Bibbiani,
that people,
I like them all.
That Bibbs, among others, don't hates, like Die Hard 2.
Hates number 2, yeah.
I'm like, what? I like Die Hard 2.
William Bibbiani is our film critic.
What, Nemesis?
Nemesis. Our arch rival.
No. He's been on this show.
Friend of podcast.
Yes. Yeah. He's also the co-host of the B-Movies podcast with Professor Whitney Seibold. You know, 3 was not my favorite, but it was pretty good.
3 is awesome because...
Sam Phillips
plays the mute German terrorist.
Right. In that. She was cast after they saw her the martinis
an album
and
cover
the cigarettes
that she was on, and they were like, get her, she looks stern. Yeah.
4, which I had not seen until just this past week because I'd never gotten around to it. Die Hard with a Vengeance, silly but entertaining. I had a good time, and you know, they take out a helicopter with a car,
right,
which is pretty awesome.
I liked it.
And as over the top as that sounds, at least has some contextual place in the story, which is something you really appreciate when you see A Good Day to Die Hard, which is a movie that is full of action stuff that has no connection to anything story-wise, physics-wise, anything.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, worth remembering, this is a series that part of the appeal of it was that this was a human guy. You know, this is 1988. We'd already had Rambo and we'd had the Terminator and all these sort of larger than life, you know,
right,
super, you know, human, like, you know, guys with guns. Here's a guy who's barefoot and stepping on glass and going, ow.
Right.
You know, it was... Yes. You know, when you prick him, he doth bleed. That was the whole thing about that was cool about John McClane, was that he was a human being, you know, but he kept his sense of humor in a, you know, really sticky wicket and all that stuff. And now he's just another cartoon character. You know, he jumps.
He's indestructible.
Yeah, he jumps through windows and out of tall buildings and, you know, gets up and goes, and gets on with it. You know, and you don't even have the time, you don't know why he's jumping out of the buildings or through the windows, because the story doesn't make any sense at all.
Right.
And it's awful to sit through.
I enjoyed the stuff. I enjoyed how loud it was. We saw it in a screening room on the Fox lot.
Dolby Atmos.
Dolby Atmos, which was crispity. And I enjoyed the explosions and I enjoyed the destruction of stuff, like when he's driving the SUV thing over the hoods, the roofs of all those cars, and just
and it doesn't ever bother
and really
you.
Really, and killing people,
yes,
I think,
clearly,
probably in
but
the process.
But it doesn't.
Innocent bystanders are dying.
As competently, you know, put together as those action sequences were. I mean, they're not bad per se, but the fact that they aren't tethered to any kind of plot or character or anything.
Just that we're in a chase, you know.
Because it's not like I want tons of story. I mean, like, you know, you look at a movie like The Raid, and it's sort of like, okay, we're here, we have to get there, go.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's enough. But this movie, you don't know where here is or there is or what anything is, and, you know.
And so I liked all the stuff. I liked all the shooting and the exploding and the punching and the killing and the jumping through stuff and the jumping out of windows and the fire, the explosions. The helicopter that explodes is great.
But were you having fun?
I was having fun looking at all that stuff. Mm-hmm. All that stuff is fun to look at. I like to watch stuff get destroyed in a movie, in an action movie, or in a period drama.
You're not picking.
It's just stuff, if things are being blown up,
okay,
I'm super happy. I'm going to get to it.
All right.
You just don't even need to interrupt me because I have a full thought that I'm fixing to deliver. You just wait.
Go on.
You just wait. If only it hadn't been a Die Hard movie, I could have walked out of that saying, not only did I love all that action stuff, but wow, that was also a good Die Hard movie. Like, why they had to call it Die Hard anything and involve Bruce Willis, who I don't think actually wanted to be in the film.
You know, you get that impression, definitely.
For example, there's a young sort of up-and-coming actor named Jay Courtney who was in this film.
Right.
And he plays Bruce Willis's son, and the script and the direction give him almost nothing to do except
pout.
Look tough, be pouty, and, you know, wear really tight T-shirts.
Yeah.
And so I get the impression, just from watching him move in films like this and like Jack Reacher, which he's also in, that he could be an action star,
mm-hmm.
and a good one.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That could work.
He has a Tom Hardy vibe. He's the smooshy nose.
He gives me a little bit of Tom Hardy. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Without the ambition. and so I thought, what if this movie were just about this guy doing this thing as the CIA guy that he is?
And all these things were blowing up.
And all these things were blowing up. I would be having a much better time, and it wouldn't have to be a Die Hard film. Because a Die Hard movie, I bring to it lots of expectations.
Yeah, that they have established.
They have established the intelligence of this franchise.
Yeah, there's going to be characters.
To one degree or another.
There's going to be some level of wit. The criminal is going to have a really interesting scheme that does not immediately become apparent, that has like other twists to it that will unfold along the way. We don't really get much of any of that.
You don't. I mean, you get a little bit of like, oh, this person's really
but it's
doing
not
this instead of this, but it's not interesting.
No. it's not compelling at all.
When they reveal who's zooming who and among the bad guys, you just think, all right,
sure.
Great.
Whatever.
Can you blow up something more now,
it's,
please?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, they have taken this great franchise and handed it over to the guy who
Who are not awesome at their jobs.
The guy who wrote Wolverine and the guy who directed Max Payne.
Great.
Both of whom, for me, belong in movie jail. And now they belong in movie jail and throw away the key, as far as I'm concerned, after this movie.
Gay Oklahoma prison. See how I brought that back?
There you go. That's a callback. Nice. Yeah. Nice. So, very, very disappointing. Big letdown.
Yeah. I mean, you know, during the film, you were sitting next to me, you probably heard me going, I was kind of down for the
sheer visceral
of it.
Thing.
Yeah.
And they're okay action sequences, but not in the service of anything. And,
no.
You know, I don't know. I guess any franchise has peaks and valleys. I hope this isn't the last one, just because I like whatever one is the last one to be awesome, which this was not.
I don't think there's going to be another one with Bruce Willis anyway, unless they give him a bazillion dollars.
Well, this one's
and let him die.
Hard. I mean, exactly. I mean, because obviously, I think part of what they're trying to do here is pass the reins to the kid now.
I'd be all right with that.
Yeah, I suppose.
Let him be something.
But again, make it better than this. Go back to the well and figure out what made that first one so good. Somebody was telling me that apparently they made the first one while Willis was on hiatus from Moonlighting because Cybill Shepherd got pregnant. And then apparently, as they got into shooting, he had to go off and do other stuff, so they were sort of forced to kind of write around him and come up with other things that didn't involve him.
Oh,
which is why you get all those scenes with Hans Gruber and with the what's his face, Hart Bochner, is the sweaty coke addict guy, and that's the stuff that really makes the movie. It's all those sideline characters, William Atherton and Paul Gleason and Reginald Vell Johnson and all
Bonnie
those guys.
Bonnie Bedelia. Is her character supposed to be still alive and around? And
I don't know. They acknowledge in the fourth one that they're apparently long divorced, I guess, and the daughter's all mad at him and using the mother's maiden name.
I see.
Then she takes it back at the end. And Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who plays the daughter in number four, does pop up for a cameo in this one.
Because it confused me. Like at the end, I thought, okay, so Mom, is Mom dead? Because if she weren't dead, wouldn't she be here to greet the the hero son?
That's true. Even if the husband and wife are estranged,
divorced
she should have been there
doesn't the, mean yeah.
Yeah, I think Bonnie Bedelia is don't call me anymore. But what is she doing that's so great?
But I don't know.
She can't take 2 days to play Holly again.
You know what? They might not have asked her.
Ooh, maybe
they might not have asked her. Maybe they don't. Maybe.
Maybe that's part of Bruce's thing. Is
maybe they're in a big fight with her or something.
Maybe Bruce Willis is all like, she's not coming back, is she? Okay, then I'll do it. No, I don't know.
We don't know. We don't know nothing.
We don't. I'm sure she's a lovely person, as are all the famous people.
All the famous people are great.
Yes.
So Beautiful Creatures is the movie we like this week.
That no one went to see.
That nobody went to see. And we don't blame you for not going to see it.
Because the trailer was terrible.
The trailer was terrible. And the trailer and all the posters that I've been seeing all around town, the billboards and the posters and the everything. Driving over to the screening, I was dreading every inch of the trip.
Do you know what Bonnie Bedelia's real last name is?
No.
Culkin.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What's that mean?
Her father was Philip Harley Culkin, a journalist. I wonder if she's related to the other Culkins.
Is her mom Amelia Bedelia?
Sadly, no. Oh, wait a minute. No. Yeah, her brother is Kit, who... She's Macaulay Culkin's aunt.
Interesting.
I never knew that.
I didn't know that either.
Wow.
Well, there you go. Okay, sorry. So Beautiful Creatures. We're done talking about Die Hard.
Look, you opened the whole Bonnie Bedelia jar. Oh, and she's on Parenthood now.
You're putting the cap on it.
So she's working.
Yeah, all right. Okay. What's she doing that's so great?
Does she have a bubblegum car?
Picture in her bubblegum car? You talk about Beautiful Creatures.
No, I've done all the plots and options.
I'm going to talk about Safe Haven. Oh, that's going to be my big...
Okay.
I'm going to tell everybody all about Safe Haven.
Are you going to spoil Safe Haven?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, that's why I'm saving it for the end.
Okay, and we'll warn you, like, when you can tune back in.
Yeah.
Beautiful Creatures. Wow. Okay, so there's this teenager in this sleepy town in South Carolina.
His name is Pugnacity Cornswallow.
And his mother is dead, and his father never leaves his bedroom. And his father is referenced throughout the film, and you keep thinking he's going to be some third actor.
He's
reveal.
Bumpy Hederer.
You never, ever see the father. He never comes out of the room.
They start this movie with these accents.
That are kind of corn pony, yeah.
Everyone's dropping their G's.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's pouring it on. Thick like Butterworth. It is very...
At first,
almost off-putting, and you worry that the whole film is going to be crazy.
Yeah, at first I was kind of sniggering at the accent of the lead actor, Alden Ehrenreich, but by the time I got used to it, then Jeremy Irons turns up with his craziness, and it was like we were off on a whole other train.
Tone it down by the middle of the film.
Is that what it is, or sort do we just get used to it?
No, it's a little both.
Anyway, so Sleepy Town, and he wants to get out, and he reads all the banned books, and is kind of an outsider, but also kind of a popular kid. And
he's that inexplicable movie creation of the popular kid who is also really smart and sensitive.
Yes.
And who does as he pleases.
Right.
Because of popularity, but what he pleases is to be sort of a discontented outsider.
Right. And without getting the crap beaten out of him after school every day.
And that sounds terrible as I'm describing it, but the film turns him into this very sort of bookish Rory Gilmore kind of character where...
But he's appealing.
He's appealing. He cannot consume banned controversial literature
fast enough.
Yeah. As though... And I honestly, truly related to this element of his character because that very same thing kind of happened to me. I say, and I opened my review on movies.com with, when I was 16, the assistant youth minister at my Southern Baptist church told me that I needed to stop reading, like it was almost a command, honestly. I needed to stop reading Catcher in the Rye because, and the word he used was, ungodly. It was ungodly. And I said...
Ungodly awesome.
I said, it's, I don't think it is ungodly. I haven't got to that part yet. Like,
maybe that's in the later chapters.
Yeah, and so... But I remember thinking, who are you to tell me about literature? Like, first of all, you're not a teacher at my school. They're knuckleheads too, but you're like even more of a knucklehead because I know you work at the auto parts store and you're just this dumb bumpkin who is also the assistant youth pastor at my church. And so, not that you're a dummy if you work at an auto parts store. My dad ran a tire store when I was a kid. But
you didn't go to him for literature tips.
No. No, never. I remember that moment thinking, not only am I going to finish this book, I am now going to begin finding all the books you hate that I shouldn't read. If it's banned or you don't like it, or someone in this church tells me
it's forbidden,
I'm gonna read it.
Well, that's how John Waters used to go to movies when he was a kid. Anything that got a condemned rating from the Catholic League of Decency like would rocket to the top of his list of movies to go see.
Good.
Anyway, so one, you know, the first day of his junior year of high school, you know, that rarest of things happens, a new face in town, and it's a girl named Lena, who has moved into the creepy old mansion at the edge of town where the old eccentric family that everybody thinks are Satanists live. And
witches. Do they say that
they're Satanists? No, they say Satanists a lot because it's a very Bible-thumpy kind of town.
Yeah.
And he is immediately smitten, although unlike other supernatural romances, they don't immediately like see each other and click. Like they have to kind of win each other over, and
right. They're
funny, and they're both, you know, eccentric and quirky. And
she reads cool books too.
Yes, she turns him on to Bukowski.
Right,
and so then she lets him know that, well, she actually is a witch, but they prefer the term caster. And she's about to turn 16, and when casters turn 16, it is their nature that determines whether they will go to the light or the dark.
And she's got the deck stacked against her because she's already got older female relatives.
Yeah, her mom,
who
her cousin
are bad.
Very much dark, yeah. Like, her mother is so dark that she's been kept away from her, like, for almost her entire life.
And is, in fact, so evil that she has taken to possessing the body of the biggest Bible thumper in town.
Right.
Yeah. Which is great.
Which is great. Yeah. And you know, so, I mean, I was thinking about this. It's like, okay, if you sat down and said, all right, I'm going to combine Twilight and Harry Potter. Like, this is about as close as you could get. Because, you know, whole thing with Harry Potter is, you know, is he dark? Is he, you know, is he gonna go Slytherin, or is he going to be, right, you know, right, Gryffindor? Thank you. I knew we'd get letters if I didn't remember that one. You know, so yeah, this is very much cobbled together from familiar parts. And apparently it does stray quite a bit from the popular YA novel upon which it is based. But according to the two teen gals who were at the screening we attended, they loved it. And they didn't mind that it was not, you know, true to the text.
It has more on its mind than Twilight.
Yes.
In many, 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 many ways.
No one is inert here, for one thing.
There is, yeah. Everyone is active in some way, intellectually active.
Right.
And, or stylistically. Like Emmy Rossum, her job is just to vamp around and wear cool, like, Maleficent kind of outfits and be crazy.
In my review on The Wrap, I said, like, they will be inspiring the next several seasons of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yes. Yeah. And the good and the bad people have interesting philosophies behind who they are and why they want to be the way they are.
And what they do.
And
Margot Martindale carries a peacock.
I was going to get to that, and I will in just a moment. But I like the idea that Lena's mother, her Emma Thompson, makes this kind of compelling case for going to the dark, before the big showdown,
right?
She's like, "Oh, you want to give this up for the love?
Yeah,
like give this for this boy,
for a mortal."
And she says, and I wrote this down quickly because I knew it had to be in my review. She says, "Love was created to give females something to play with instead of power." And it felt like just the biggest slap in the face to Twilight, which is this very sort of like cloistered, chastity-based film about control.
And a woman defining herself.
Not just a film, but the entire series.
A woman defining herself by her choice in men.
Yeah. And so I thought it was this movie is smarter, cooler, weirder, and everything else-er than I ever thought it would be walking into that screening.
It's a lot more entertaining than you would imagine, than I certainly imagined, you know, because, yeah, it just, the trailer was terrible. It looked like sort of half-baked Twilight with ridiculous accents. But it's, you know, and it's got a really, really good cast. Right. I mean,
Eileen Atkins,
Viola Davis, you know, Kyle Gallner, like, they really, you know, like, cast even the small roles with really cool actors.
But Alonso loves Margot Martindale.
I adore Margot Martindale.
Alonso loves Margot Martindale a lot, and
if you've seen Paris Je T'aime, you know why.
You know why.
I love Margot Martindale.
You really
should
see Paris Je T'aime, if only for the very last segment that was directed by Alexander Payne, where Margot Martindale plays a postal worker
from Nebraska
who goes to Paris on vacation by herself.
Yeah,
she narrates the entire short 5 to 7 minute film
in French.
In
her learning French.
Yeah, this sort of, you know, French as a second language, French. Yeah. And it is the most moving, sweet, and
heartbreaking and inspirational.
Yeah, it's the best. And so I had seen her in a lot of things before Paris Je T'aime, but I didn't know her name. Until Paris Je T'aime.
There are actors that you see, and you see them all the time, but then they do that one performance, you're like, who is that? I need to know.
Yeah.
And that was my... Margot Martindale, that's her name.
That's her name, and I will never forget that name now because she's great.
Yeah.
So she
was just on the Smash season premiere.
Oh, was she?
In this very sort of Margaret Dumont, like, fancy, you know, she runs the theater wing of lady. And I was like, this is so great because she usually gets cast as, like, Ma Kettle.
Right.
So to
or
see
the
her,
frumpy suburban mother.
Exactly. Yeah. So to see her as, like, fancy New York lady who's being all tut-tut disapproving, I was like, yay, Margot Martindale.
So she shows up, and she's dressed insanely, because all the familial characters in this, all the witch family characters, are dressed in crazy outfits for the entire film.
Jeffrey Curlin designed the costumes. Again, a name I bothered to check.
And
her hair is
very all crazy, and she's got feathers in her hair, and she's holding a live peacock. That's her entrance into the film. And so here's what happens. I'm sitting in the arc light, and it's me and you, and right next to you is
Bibbs,
and then
Matt Atchety.
And Matt Atchety from What the Flick, and Ben from What the Flick, Ben Mankiewicz, and Christy Lemire from What the Flick are right in front of us.
Right.
So it's like everyone we know, the Schmoes are like two rows down, or right behind us maybe. No, Mark from the Schmoes was right behind us. It's not a fairly noisy scene at all. It's kind of quiet in the movie. She just shows up, and here's what Alonso Duralde does. Now, what you can't see on the microphone is me spreading my fingers wide and clapping like that, in that crazy, like, that crazy intersection of 5-year-old child and exuberant gay dude. And the squee noise. That's what you did. Christy whipped her head around.
Oh, yeah, no, she referenced it on this
and
week's
was like,
the Flick.
What is going on in this row?
I have to say, I did not
furthermore,
know
furthermore, that prompted you and Bibbs to begin this little tittering sort of thing that went on through the entire rest of the movie. Anytime anything delighted either one of you, I heard this. Well, like, because, I'm going to separate you.
Because, you know what? I tried telling you funny things during the movie.
I can't hear
you. And you do the thing that you always do, which is you point to your ear because you're
deaf.
Which means
I can't hear you.
Because you spent your teenage years standing in front of the amps at Black Flag shows.
That's right.
And now I have to suffer for it because anytime
I'm
we're
sorry.
Movie,
you hadn't ought to be talking during the movie anyway.
Well, I'm allowed.
You know, the movie goes on and you go quiet.
When the movie is loud, I know how to whisper it to people who are not stone deaf.
But it's too loud for me. The movie, the loudness of the movie negates my ability to hear you.
Well, obviously,
even at your loudest stage whisper.
But it's annoying.
No, you're annoying.
I have things to share.
You're annoying because you're bugging me while the movie's going on.
I don't know. You do it to me.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do.
Only when we're alone in a really, really crappy movie.
Anyway.
Not when there's folks all around us.
I did not know that Margot Martindale was in the movie at all.
Right.
Much less carrying a live peacock. So for me, that was probably the most like giddy delight I've had in a movie since the Let's Hear It for the Boy sequence in the Footloose remake.
Oh, you did it then too, yeah.
That was the last
I remember you doing that during that movie.
I clapped my chubby little hands together in joy. Oh,
time to take that cake out of the oven.
Yes, so why don't you talk...
Pause it.
No.
All right, Safe Haven.
You talk about Safe Haven.
Here's what's going to happen. I'm fixing to tell you about Safe Haven. Now, this movie has an insane twist ending. Like, a twist ending so nuts that it almost merits watching. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you all about the movie, what happens in the movie. And then before it's time to spoil the twist ending, which I am going to do, because obviously some of you are not going to see this movie. Before I spoil the movie, I will tell you that I'm going to spoil the movie, and then you can turn down your podcast for exactly 2 minutes. I will spend 2 minutes spoiling and discussing the insane plot twist that takes place at the end. Okay, but you will be warned. I will tell you when I'm going to do it, so you can listen until I tell you otherwise.
I should have let it cool in the pan before I popped it out.
Did you already pop it out?
Yeah.
Is it in one piece?
It's in one piece, but there's kind of a crack in it.
It doesn't matter.
It's not the end of the world.
The folks that you're going to serve that thing to tomorrow, they don't care.
True.
If you really want to make it, you want to seal it back up. We'll make, you don't put powdered sugar on it, uh-huh. Make a powdered sugar icing glaze, mm-hmm. And that'll just like cement it on.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they will love that.
Indeed.
Yeah. I'll help you.
Okay, thank you.
I'm good in the kitchen.
You are.
All right, so this is based on a Nicholas Sparks novel.
Hooray.
Which means that the men all wear the best weathered vintage flannel shirts ever. Like, the kind you can never find in the store. You're looking for a flannel shirt like the one that Josh Duhamel wears in this movie. You're like, how come I can't find that?
They only
shirt
get
anywhere?
Distressed that way, yeah. If you build barns.
I know.
And paint picket fences.
I know.
By the ocean.
I know.
And reach out to emotionally damaged women looking to start over again.
Well, I reach out to you every day.
I'm sorry, your flannel shirts are not nice enough.
And but there's nothing to, there's no room to build a barn. We live in the middle of Los Angeles, so I can't. Anyway, Julianne Hough.
Speaking of the Footloose remake.
Speaking of the Footloose remake. Who's completely appealing, although I can't tell you anything about why I find her appealing.
Really? Because I think she's the walking embodiment of Escape from Planet Earth. Like, she's just, there's
well,
nothing
that's what
there.
I mean. Like, there's nothing going on with her at all, mm-hmm. But I think she's just cute. Like, she's like baby blonde Jennifer Aniston, but no...
With no rough edges.
With nothing going on, you know? She just has that sort of, like, I'm adorable kind of face about her.
She is a rocky place where my interest can find no purchase.
I'm not interested in her, but I'm not mad at her either.
Mm.
So she's on the run from something bad. She has done something bad. Mm-hmm. You know this because she's got blood on her hands in the opening scene. And she runs across the street to the old lady next door. And is like, oh, look what I've done. Oh, my God. Ah! And the next thing you see her, she's got her hair cut short and blonde, dyed blonde, and she's on a bus. She's on a bus to nowhere.
And do they sing Sister Christian?
No. That's in the other film that she's in, Rock of Ages.
Ah, okay.
She gets on the bus, and there's a cop chasing her.
Mm-hmm.
He's after her.
Mm-hmm.
And the cop, you know, does everything he can to get to her.
Does he pull the bus over?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But he doesn't get her. He doesn't find her. She eludes him.
Mm.
She winds up, like, North Carolina, South Carolina, some coastal southern
state. It's always some southern coastal.
And she rents a tiny little cabin.
Is she on a bed and breakfast on stilts?
No, she's a tiny little cabin in the woods to be away from everything.
Uh-huh.
Her nearest neighbor is a woman who lives about, you know, half mile down the road, we figure. in another little tiny cabin in the woods. And together they are two females who are escaping complicated pasts.
Is there a redneck zombie family?
No. That's in another film entitled Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, okay.
And so the so they become sort of tentative friends. Like Julianne Hough is never super into the neighbor, but you know,
she's trying to be nice.
Chats to her, uh-huh. You know. Talks to her. She sort of wants to be left alone, but she realizes that, you know, she's in a little town. She's going to have to be cordial to some folks.
Right.
She decides she's going to paint her floor yellow. Okay. Why?
Okay.
To cheer it up.
Where do you
This go? Doesn't make sense to me.
Where do you go when you paint your floor? Like, what other room
are
you...
To the other room.
I see.
Okay. Yeah. This act of hers does not make sense to me because the rest of the walls, all the walls in this place are just dingy, dirty white, and they clearly need painting too.
But she paints the floor.
She paints the floor first. I'm like, you know what? You're going to have to get a lot of drop cloths.
I was going to say, you do the floor last.
You do the floor last, yeah, but that's not, we're not, the movie's not about painting the floor.
No, okay. But you're talking about it.
It should be.
It would be more interesting.
She meets Josh Duhamel, who runs a general store. He's the best kind of straight dude, a widower.
Ooh, with kids.
Yeah, with two kids. One of the kids is sullen and misses dead mom. Mm-hmm. And the other kid, the girl, she's a little older, and she instantly takes to Julianne Hough.
Because she's adorable.
And they, you know, quickly start hanging out. Josh Duhamel takes off his shirt, and they go to the beach, and he's got a, you know, nice old truck or whatever. And
of course
they go canoeing, and they get caught in the rain.
Of course they do.
They make out in the rain and stuff. And so here are some details.
From the author of The Notebook, everybody. Remember how much you liked The Notebook?
Nicholas Sparks loves it when folks write letters. And I agree with Nicholas Sparks about this. People should write letters.
You've never written me a letter.
It's because I've never been away from you.
There is that.
I can't get away from you. Talk about sleeping with the enemy.
Oh, excuse me.
Can't get away.
You're the enemy, if anything. You're the one. How? You're the one who rearranges the towels and puts all the cans label side out. You would be the enemy.
That's in this just
scenario.
Logical.
I would be.
That just makes for an efficiently run home.
I would be the freewheeling, life-loving Julia Roberts this.
No.
You would be the uptight, violent.
I
Patrick
believe
Burton.
We've already determined that if anyone is freewheeling on this show,
no,
it's
no.
The freewheeling.
Only
it's
you.
The freewheeling Dave White.
Only you have designated yourself as freewheeling. No one else on earth
the
has ever met you.
The freewheeling Dave
call
White.
You freewheeling.
Yeah.
So you're the enemy. I'm sleeping.
Did we screw up the intro by not saying each other's names?
Oh, did we not?
Did I just say you are the film critic for the...
We might, that's actually, yes.
You're Alonzo Duralde and I'm Dave White.
52 minutes into the show for
I'm
you.
The freewheeling.
For you.
The freewheeling Dave White.
Ostensible first-time listeners, yeah. We're now identifying ourselves, Way to go. Bad podcasts have it over us in this department of introducing things and telling people what they're listening to.
We'll get better at that. We've only been doing this 2 years now.
Yeah.
We'll get much
we're
better.
We're 100 and change in, so, you know.
So the
so they make out in the rain.
So they make out
in
the rain. Okay. The dead mom has left behind in her special desk a series of letters to be given to the children as they, you know, turn 15 and turn 18 and graduate from high school.
So like My Life Without Me.
And get married, yeah. And this is, you know, this is a very sweet gesture on the dying mother's part.
Or for that matter, My Life. Doesn't Michael Keaton do this?
I don't remember.
Anyway.
All dying people do this now.
Apparently
they make
so.
Videotapes.
They've got time.
They make videotapes. They write letters to give to the kids.
Yes.
I think it's a nice trend. It's a trending thing for the dying to do this.
It's all the rage.
So the cop is still...
It's all the rage against the dying of the life.
All the cop is... You're interrupting my narrative. The cop is chasing Julianne Hough.
Yes, right. The cop who pulled over the bus.
And he posts a wanted poster everywhere up and down the East Coast. Mm.
The Eastern Seaboard.
And he finally finds the town where she is, and he makes sure he's you know... He posts the thing, and she's wanted for murder.
Murder.
We don't know who she's murdered. We assume she murdered her ex, her now ex-husband.
Yeah, who was her late husband.
Mean to her. Josh Duhamel finds this wanted poster. He's like, what's the meaning of this, you murderess? And I let you around my children and
blah. Does he say murderess?
No, that was just kind of, I was hoping he would say. Yeah.
God, nobody uses that word.
Murderess is, well, feminism.
Oh, I'd say it's like comedian. It's not fair to hardworking murderers.
Actress.
Yeah.
You know, you.
They should be treated equally.
Right? Honestly, you know, I'm totally down. I believe in feminism all the way. But I do love the S endings of words. They're great. It lets you know that it's a lady murderer.
Are you a lady murderer?
And so
we're going to flip all the cards.
So she's like, no, it's, you know, you don't understand. You know, I don't think I murdered anybody. You know, like, and he's like, what do you mean? You know, okay. So this is not the big spoiler. This is not the big tease, the big twist ending. Mm-hmm. But you come to realize that the cop who is chasing Julian Huff is actually the husband that she stabbed.
Dun, dun, dun.
And you know this like 3 minutes in. You're like, yeah. Okay, no, he's just a bad maniac cop who's chasing her to catch her and pretending that he is chasing a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
So he finds her. Meanwhile, in the midst of all this, she's having a prickly conversation with the lady down the road that she's friends with. And the lady down the road that she's friends with just shows up from time to time and sort of counsels her and stuff, you know. And Julian Huff is always like, why are you bugging me? You know, like, this, you never get the feeling that they're great friends, but the lady down the road really wants to be her friend.
The Budinsky next door, Gladys Kravitz.
And so finally Julian Huff is like, you know what? Leave me alone. You have been hiding out in the woods just like me, and you need to move on with your life and leave town. Quit bugging me. And so they have a fight. And this really bums out the lady down the road, whose name I just cannot remember. The character name I can't remember. This is all happening as the deranged cop husband is, you know, chasing her and finding her. He finds her on the 4th of July, which means that lots of fireworks are going off all the time, so there's lots of noise in the town, and, you know, everything can... That'll obscure a lot of gunfire and other violence that's taking place.
Because I'm sure people are shooting their guns in the air because it's the South.
No, just fireworks.
Oh, okay.
Just fireworks.
And I'm from the South. I get
this
to say
is
that.
The civilized South where people are polite and they're sweet to each other and they're nice and and they all have these great sort of weather-beaten
trucks,
everything and
are there any black people in town? Just out of curiosity, in this version,
I don't
of the South?
Remember. I don't. There are none that make an impression. Like there might be some background.
Are there's some under fives, maybe? Or,
yeah, like maybe in crowd scenes there are some.
Because, you know, Knights and Rodanthe at least gave us, you know, Viola Davis as the heroine's black friend.
Right, yes.
To show that the heroine has a black friend.
Yes. And so he catches her and he, you know, is like, you must come with me. And she's kind of going to play him for a bit and be like, okay, yeah, you know, I'll come with you, you know.
Let me pack a bag.
And he sets the general store on fire.
The general store that is run by Josh Duhamel.
That's run by Josh Duhamel. And he's wrestling her to the ground, and she shoots him dead, and Josh Duhamel doesn't have to save her. He has to save his daughter, who's upstairs in mommy's old office, where the desk is with all the letters in it. So he saves the daughter. Julian Huff kills the bad guy. Ta-da. The end. We can all live happily ever after.
Now comes the twist part.
Now comes the twist.
All right. I'm going to
set the timer for 2 minutes.
Okay, hold on.
Okay.
This is my cake timer that I'm not using anymore. All right. So if you don't want to find out the shocking twist ending of Safe Haven... Directed by the formerly
and you really honestly,
Lasse
if you have
Hallström.
Any inkling to go see this movie at all, you don't want to know right now what it is because it's too crazy. You want the joy. You want the giggle out loud moment that happened. Well, at least for me, when I went to see this.
I'm sure the other ladies there were not appreciating your guffawing.
I don't care. They had their phone on in the movie. They take what they can get.
All right. Okay. So,
or rather, they get what they deserve.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. So fast forward 2 minutes if you don't want to hear the spoiler, starting now.
Okay. The lady friend down the road has moved on. She took Julian Hough's advice. They made up. They patched up as friends. But she said, you know, you made me realize it's time for me to go. So she goes away. And Julian Hough and Josh Duhamel and the kids live happily ever after. And not long after that, Josh Duhamel hands Julian Hough a letter.
So the letters didn't go up in the fire?
No, they were saved from the fire. Because, you know, magic. The things made of paper.
She wrote all the letters on asbestos.
And so he hands her the letter, and the letter is addressed to her. It says, and she opens up the letter, and the letter says, to the woman my husband loves. You know, congratulations, you've hit the jackpot. You've got Josh Duhamel. And
you may already be his second wife.
Yeah, and he loves you so much, or else he wouldn't have given you this letter, and I instructed him, you know, give this to her when you meet the one, you know, because she's that forward-thinking.
1 minute.
Okay. She opens up the letter, she reads the whole letter, and there's a photo in the letter, and it's the lady down the road. It was a ghost the whole time. She had a ghost pal. Ghost friends were guiding her and giving her advice. And every time you saw Julian Hough walking through town talking to the ghost, it was just Julian Hough just babbling to herself.
Ooh, Fight Club, Sixth Sense.
And people in the town being like, steer clear of the crazy blonde girl talking to herself. Ta-da, ghost friends.
Wow.
How many minutes do I have?
You have 25 seconds.
Okay, well, it's great. Everything up to this point in the film is super boring and predictable and Nicholas Sparksy. Mm. This really just kicked it into jam territory for me. Like, I'm telling people now to see this movie.
Okay, time. You know, What I find depressing about all this is...
what are you depressed about? There's nothing depressed about that awesome twist ending.
Not that twist ending, just this movie in general. Is that Lasse Hallström...
Whatever.
Used to be...
No.
Yes.
My Life is a Dog.
My Life is a Dog.
Dude, that's it.
Once Around was great.
Once Around is fine. My Life is a Dog is a wonderful, sweet film of the 80s. You should all see My Life is a Dog. Almost nothing else he's done since.
But yeah, no. Yeah,
whatsoever.
He got sucked into the like Harvey Weinstein, you know, prestige machine, and started putting out movies like
Chocolat,
and The Ship. Oh no, he did What's Eating Gilbert Grape. That was the other.
What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
But okay, yeah, yes. He did Chocolat and The Cider House Rules and The Shipping News and.
Yeah.
You know, last year he did Salmon Fishing in the Yemen.
He's the king of everything dull.
But yeah, you know, it's like. But I'm looking at this real quick. You know, My Life is a Dog, Once Around, What's Eating Gilbert Grape. Even Something to Talk About was okay. And then forget it. So, yeah, it's just depressing. But I'm sure, you know, he makes a lot of money directing this stuff. And he gets to be married to Lena Olin. So, you know.
She's nice.
Good on him. Last one real quick, you didn't see, but I did, was No. The Chilean entry for the Oscars, which is up for Best Foreign Film this year, stars Gael García Bernal. It's based on a true story. Apparently, at some point in the late 80s, the Pinochet regime was under fire, and his U.S. backers said, you need to, like, at least try and fake that you are democratically elected and popular. So he announced that there would be a plebiscite, basically, like a referendum where people would either vote yes or no. Yes, Pinochet stays in office, or no, he doesn't. And so the movie is about this advertising guy who kind of runs the campaign for the no side. Because the way it works out is that they're going to get...
What's that?
That's my timer going off again for some reason.
For what?
I don't know.
Fix that. Turn off your phone. You're always scolding me to turn off mine.
Anyway, so he's the ad guy for the no side. And, you know, because the way it's going to work out is they're going to get 15 minutes of uncensored TV every night on, like, state-run television. So as somebody on the other side says, yes, they get the no side gets 15 minutes, the yes side gets 15 minutes, and the rest of the day. And so he meets with, like, all of the like, this coalition of leftists, and they're like, well, we're not going to win this thing, but we at least want to be able to tell the people of Chile all the horrible things that Pinochet has done. So they put together this whole spot that's about, like, you know, the disappeared people and the torture and the da-da-da-da-da-da. And he's like, no, we can win this thing, but no one is going to vote. You can't appeal to voters with something negative. So let's pitch them happiness. So he puts together this entire ad campaign that's like any other ad campaign. It's, you know, people riding horseback in sun-dappled meadows and, you know, picnics and da-da-da. And it's he basically does this whole thing where they never mention Pinochet. They never mention the government. It's just like, vote for happiness. Vote no. And so the movie is...
Because you already know what sadness is because you already live with Pinochet.
Exactly. So, right. So the movie is basically like the creating of this ad campaign, and then, of course, you know, all the people working on the ad campaign getting like scary middle-of-the-night visits from, you know, government, you know, goons. And
heavies.
Heavies, yeah.
Heavies.
And it's perfectly okay, this movie. It's just not all that compelling given what a crazy story this is, that it's a real thing. All the advertising stuff kind of feels familiar. I mean, like, going back as far as you know, A Face in the Crowd, which, you know, is a movie that's almost as old as television itself, you know, the idea that you sell politicians as a product is nothing that earth-shattering. And then, you know, and the stuff with the government guys just feels like a kind of generic political thriller. And the Bernal character, the Garcia Bernal character, his main thing is, you know, like, he's raising his son, but he really misses his wife, who, you know, is like the super committed radical, so she never is around. And, you know, this isn't a bad movie, and that there's a lot of cool stuff in it. But ultimately, it could have been a lot more interesting, and it just sort of lies there, I think, for the most part. But it's worth seeing, if nothing else, for the ads, which I assume are based on what the real ad campaign looked like.
Probably, yeah.
Because, you know, and this isn't a spoiler, because it happened in the real world, the no side won. Like, the Pinochet stepped down from office because he lost his own referendum because of this crazy ad campaign. So, yeah, it's worth checking out. It's such a compelling story that you want the movie to be as bold as the people that it's about, but it's still okay.
Great.
I want to thank the Secretly Timid podcast for giving us a nice shout out this week. They had originally acknowledged that they'd gotten it from us, the idea that every week they would sort of read out the bunch of lists of other podcasts to check out.
Yeah.
And then they decided that rather than do that, that they would pick one podcast a week that they would all listen to and they would all talk about for a bit at the end.
One podcast above all others.
And so this week it was...
That's us.
It was ours, and we appreciate it.
What did they say about me? Because I haven't listened to this yet.
I don't know that they...
I will, but I want to know what praise was delivered in my direction.
I think they talked about us. They didn't talk about us individually. So deal with it, Dave White. You are nothing without me.
That's untrue.
Anyway, but one of the things that John mentioned that he really liked about the show was the DVD recommendations.
I've got one.
So what do you got?
Andrei Tarkovsky's final film, 1986's The Sacrifice.
Uh-huh.
It is just brand new right now on Netflix streaming.
Tarkovsky, and probably best known as the director of Solaris.
Yes. It is, for me, one of my favorite Tarkovsky films. It's not
difficult?
Not as
brooding.
Not as, yeah, yeah. It's a little less.
He's a contemporary of Bergman. Right?
Yeah. Little less. Sort of. You took the word brooding right out of my mouth than his earlier films, but for me, this is a very maybe one of the heaviest kind of more devastating kind of films because it's about a man who must. As the title says, sacrifice everything to save the world from nuclear holocaust. Hmm. Have you seen it?
I actually never have.
All right.
Although, oddly enough, it is referenced in the comic book or the graphic novel of Watchmen.
Oh, okay. Well,
very thematic.
An older, you know, teacher, actor, sort of esthete.
Mm-hmm.
is at his country house with his family, and it's for his birthday. And they, at dinner, they hear the sound of, you know, the nuclear bombs in whatever distance they are. You know, the World War III is beginning.
Right.
The world
they're
is
like going on to, an island somewhere.
Yeah, the world is going to end. And he prays to God and says, if you will take all of this back, I will give up everything. If the world can be saved and my family's lives can be saved, I will give up everything. My house, my life, my relationships to my family.
So it's like reverse Job.
Yeah. And he wakes up the next day and everything's back to normal. And you don't know if it really happened or if it was a dream, but he sets about to...
keep his end of the deal.
Keep his end of the deal.
Wow.
And they don't know why he's doing it, and they can't know why he's doing it. They don't know what's happening. Mm. And so not only does he have to give up everything, but he will never be recognized
as the savior of mankind.
Wow. And it's devastating.
And yeah, that sounds like a bummer.
It's Russian. It's about 2.5 hours long. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And it's about, you know, what things cost. And so I think, you know, I'm getting a reputation as being like, here's my DVD recommendation, Punishment. But you know what? I don't care. Because I just had to talk about 4 different movies, the best of which was a film about teen witches. So this is just a little balance for the home team here. All right. You go watch Andrei Tarkovsky's The Sacrifice, then you come back and you talk to me about teen witches and safe havens. That's there.
All right.
I've said my thing.
I was going to recommend Francois Ozon's Water Drops on Burning Rocks, but it's out of print on DVD. So instead, I will recommend Francois Ozon's 8 Women.
Which is not as good.
What?
No, it's not. Not as good.
I disagree. I mean, I think they're different films. They're very different things.
One's great and one's okay.
God, I have never contradicted you on a DVD recommendation. I don't know why you're getting in my grill.
Sometimes these things have to be done. Water Drops on Burning Rocks is great. If you can go find it, find it.
Well, it's terrific, and it's
Eight Women is completely entertaining.
Screenplay. Eight Women is
absolutely entertaining.
But I think Eight Women has more to it than you're giving it credit for.
I don't think so. Keep talking.
Dave White.
Tell me things.
Is talking out of his buttocks.
No.
8 Women is a murder mystery, and it's a musical, and it is it stars 8 sort of leading French actresses from the very young Ludivine Sanier, who's been in several other Ozon films, including Swimming Pool, all the way up to Danielle Darrieux from The Earrings of Madame De.
I will say it's wonderful to see all these women in the film.
Yeah,
they're great.
Catherine Deneuve is in it, and Emmanuel Bayard, and Isabelle Huppert, and Fanny Ardant, and, you know, it's a terrific cast.
I'm super into Fanny Ardant, and I don't know why.
She's great. Like,
well, I mean, other than the fact that she's great, but she has this physical presence that I'm super into. She carries around this sort of voluptuousness that I respond to.
You know, she was Truffaut's last lover.
I did not know that about her.
Yeah, anyway, shut up, Dave White. 8 Women is really great, and you should see it. It's a movie about. It's set in the 60s, so it's a movie about sort of female empowerment or lack thereof, and about kind of women having to carve out their own place in a society that treats them as second-class citizens. But at the same time, like I said, it's a murder mystery, and it's a musical, and it's the costume design is amazing, because pretty much like each costume sort of expresses what that character is about, and each woman sort of represents a different flower, which they sort of unfold in the credits, and it's got a really cool visual style to it. The songs are all sort of hit French pop songs, which none of which I knew going
of the era
of various eras.
Oh, okay, I don't remember that part.
But yeah, it's a film I like a lot. It's a very different film from Water Drops on Burning Rocks, which is more kind of a psychological cat and mouse sort of thing. But Ozon is one of my favorite directors working today. I think, you know, he's done a lot of really powerful films. If you haven't seen Time to Leave.
Under the Sand. Yeah, Under the Sand is really great.
I always like the one that was like,
Criminal Lovers is great.
What's the one about the couple that's divorcing and it's kind of told backwards? It's something like 4x2 or something.
5x2?
5x2.
Something like
that. Yeah, I like that one a lot. Swimming Pool is really entertaining. I think
Get Under the Sand. So, that's the one.
Yeah, there's a lot of Ozon films that are. If you have not been keeping up with him, you know, check him out. So that's
letters. Yeah, we have three of them.
Okay.
This is from Reese. Hello, Dave and Alonzo. Love the podcast and love it more since you mentioned Real Genius. This movie used to play on repeat on HBO, and I watched it at least 50 times, possibly more. How do you two feel about the movie Weird Science? I only mention this because, like Real Genius, Weird Science played what seemed like a continuous loop.
I love Weird Science because I'm a big John Hughes fan. I saw that. I had seen 16 Candles and Breakfast Club on opening day, so I made it a point to see Weird Science on opening day, even though I had just had my wisdom teeth taken out. I will always sort of remember that happening. But
we both have two tooth
stories
today.
Tooth stories is my favorite David Byrne
dentistry
movie.
Episode.
Anyway, so Literally, yeah, but. It's Weird Science. It's not a perfect movie. There's a lot of things wrong with it, but I think it's very funny. And
my microphone is wiggling. I don't know why. All right, keep talking.
Because you keep futzing with
it. No, I'm not. It's just all right. Go
anyway. But I like it a lot. It's no coincidence that you would think of that movie in conjunction with Real Genius, because in a 10-day period, Real Genius, Weird Science, and My Science Project all opened theatrically in the summer of 1985. Yeah, I remember, I think it was Newsweek that collectively referred to them as my Real Weird Genius Science Project. And they all bombed. But I think they all have their own cults. Of differing magnitude. I think My Science Project probably the least
cultish.
I think Weird Science is funny. I think it's a very inspired Anthony Michael Hall performance. It's the best thing Kelly LeBrock ever did. And it's the first thing that I think that's the first movie I remember Robert Downey Jr. from.
Yeah.
Because it was a year or two before Less Than Zero.
Mm.
So yeah, I like Weird Science.
This one's from Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
Greetings, y'all. During a recent conversation with one of my close friends, we decided to make the upcoming Academy Awards actually mean something. How are you doing that? Single-handedly making them mean something.
Tell me more.
We decided to make a bet on the award show by picking each award and then tallying up the points at the end. Sounds typical. Yes. But since we are both movie fans, we decided to add a spin to the bet by agreeing to a terrible movie to watch of the other person's choosing. Like the loser? Is it the loser has to watch?
The loser has to watch the bad movie.
Yeah. All right. I decided my friend would have to watch Bride Wars.
Oof.
Which is very bad. And he decided I would have to watch The Love Guru.
Oh.
Which is very bad. Neither of us has seen the other's choice, so I have two questions for y'all. One, who picked the worst movie out of the two of us? Your friend hates you.
Yeah, you got the really bad end of the deal.
You better not lose.
Yeah.
You lose and you watch The Love Guru,
you're in for a world of
hurt. You will not want to be friends with your friend anymore. Mm. It's I'm serious. Bride Wars at least has International Butter Club. Something that we have taken with us. Alonzo and I took the concept of International Butter Club with us into our daily lives. There is a scene where one of the girls is trying to get the other girl fat before her wedding.
So she can't fit into her dress
because it's a bride war. And she subscribes her to the International Butter Club.
No. What happens is she keeps sending all these baskets of cookies to the office.
Yeah.
And finally somebody clues her into what's going on. And they're like, she's just sending you these cookies, you'll get fat. It's like, does this mean no more International Butter Club?
Okay, well, whatever.
three words in an otherwise forgettable movie.
I went home and Googled International Butter Club after that film and was hoping it was a real thing. It is not.
No.
But what we have done in the interim is made our own International Butter Club. When we go to the grocery store now, I'd say once every couple of months, you know, when it fits in the budget, we get one expensive brand of butter from some other country. From
France or Ireland.
Yeah, 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 like in at the specialty grocery store, and we enjoy an international butter. It's a great way to live. I will tell you, your life will be super enriched by enjoying butters from many lands.
Pick up a crusty baguette somewhere.
Yep.
Let your international butter get to room temperature and soft and enjoy.
International Butter Club.
So we got that from Bride Wars. We got nothing from Love Guru.
Except hate.
Nothing.
Yeah. So two, if I lose, am I a jerk for making my lovely and devoted girlfriend watch The Love Guru with me?
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah, if you care about your relationship, send your girlfriend as far away from the house as possible while you're watching Love.
Because it'll actually, the movie, while it's playing in your DVD player, will actually emit a stench.
That will cover your entire home.
Yeah, and when she comes back, she's going to be like, what stinks?
So
have you been having sex with a pile of garbage while I'm gone?
Send her.
And because it's going to smell like sex and garbage.
Send her out.
When it's over.
To buy really.
You're going to have to clean the whole house.
Here's the thing. Send her out to buy really nice candles while you're watching Love Guru. And then when she comes home and is faced with a giant black cloud of stink, she can light a fragrant candle. And it will help begin to dissipate the overall agony that was The Love Guru.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you better win that pool.
Yeah, you better win. You're in trouble if you don't win.
Yeah. Was there one more?
One more. Mm-hmm. From Paul Tran. Oh, we're calling back Panda Go Panda. Thank you for suggesting Panda Go Panda. I've been giving you... Did you suggest it specifically to him in a private message or something?
I think we've mentioned it on the show before.
Yeah. It's one of the best kid. Little, and I mean little kids.
Like two or three years old.
2 or 3 years old.
Yeah. We need to send one to my brother and his wife.
Yeah, you do. Thank you for suggesting Panda Go Panda. I've been giving this to my friends who have kids, and they are now complaining that it's all the kids will watch. I love that it is kid crack, and I hope this will turn them into cool adults. Happy Vietnamese New Year.
Paul Tran, who has left Dallas and left Secretly Timid.
Right.
We miss him from that show, and if we were in Dallas, we'd miss him from there, too.
But correct.
We're not.
But we're not in neither of those places, so we actually don't miss him at all. Sorry, Paul Tran.
We miss the idea of you, even though you haven't really gone anywhere different from where you were before, in our hearts. Okay.
Time to go. We're done.
We thank you for listening, as always, and we suggest you check out our friends in the podcast universe, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash, The Game Night Guys, and, as mentioned, Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this program on iTunes, and if you would leave us a review there, that would be great. It's been a while since anyone left us a review.
So yeah, what's up?
If you're a listener and have not schlepped over there and left us some lovely
don't sleep on loving us.
Words of encouragement and 5 stars that we totally deserve, please do that. We would appreciate it. It helps people find the show. You can stream the show at Stitcher Radio and thelounge.com. And we have a Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. Please like us there, and you'll see links to our DVD recommendations and other stuff that we've mentioned on the show. You can follow us at Twitter, at LinoleumCast, or follow us individually. I'm at A. Duraldi, A-D. Nice one, Dave.
What just happened?
You just knocked the plugs over. A. Duraldi, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E. You can follow Dave at D. Leland White, D-L-E. LANDWHITE.
The letter D is my name, Dave. Leland. Leland is my middle name. Yeah. LELAND. White. D. Leland White.
I'll post links to that on Facebook, too. You can check into the show at getglue.com, and you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Send us your 10 favorite movies. Send us questions, comments, whatever else.
Money.
That's always good.
Gifts. International butters.
International butters, absolutely. So next weekend is Spirit Awards and Academy Awards, and we'll be glad to have all that in our rearview mirror, but we'll talk about it to some extent or another. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Goodbye.